All right. Hello, Tony. I have set the recording, so hello again.
Hello. It's nice to be broadcast live to your people and friends.
Yeah, and it's very, very nice to meet you. I don't know how many people that listen to Awakening Together will be familiar with you to start with, so I think maybe a really good place for us to start is just kind of with your story, if you don't mind.
Well, it's a long story, so I will highlight a few of the most important points. As a child, actually, my first question to the world was, why am I here? What is the purpose of everything? Just because I'm told by my parents that I've always been very curious. So I had an inclination to just ask all sorts of questions. It tired my family out to no end, but I didn't stop asking them, especially when relating to the more deep questions, you know, why, what is the meaning of life? So for me, this is my first remembrance of becoming more conscious, which I think everyone goes through this sort of inquiry, and what is the meaning behind everything. And for me, it didn't stop there. It continued, and I'm told by my parents and people who know me and who have known me growing up that I asked all sorts of very interesting and strange questions that didn't really relate to the social environment that I grew up in. And I continued questioning everything to the point where I realized that the answers don't really exist outside of myself, even though I respected everyone around me very deeply and loved them very much. I realized at some point around the age of 15 that the answer must be in a more subtle place than outside in the world. So I started looking inside of myself and inside of consciousness through meditation and asking the question again to myself, what is all this about? And so started learning meditation, a type of TM technique run by a group of very famous psychologists at a university. And that was my sort of jump into the spiritual realm. And even though my family were not religious or spiritual in an obvious way, I was very fascinated by the whole journey. And so it has continued for many, many years ever since. And I suppose the question never really gets answered because we are limited by our human experience and perspective of life. But at some point, at the age of 27, I came to a sort of understanding or comfortable place within myself where the question no longer was put out to the world in the same way. I felt more comfortable not asking the question and just teaching, because I felt that what I understood was now possible to share rather than to just keep to myself. So I began the journey of teaching meditation to a few people to start with, just a few people who knew me, and now it has been my life ever since for many, many years, teaching, I don't know how many people, hundreds of thousands of people probably, about meditation. But still, I'm very curious and still I have questions that come up to the surface that help me understand that no matter how much we think we know, there is always more to learning than that which we know. So I continue to be curious and continue to look at things from different perspectives.
All right, thank you.
That's a short answer.
I am absolutely certain that is the short version of the story. I know my own story well enough to know that there has to be more than this, but it gives me some things to begin with. I made a few notes as you were speaking because I find I have a very short memory. I'm always just listening in the present, and if I don't write down something that you said, then by the time we come around to where it's my turn to speak, I'm empty again. So the first thing I wrote down that you said that really interested me was you said the answers don't exist outside of myself. You discovered this at a very young age, and this is when you turned to meditation. But, you know, one thing that I find very interesting when I talk to a lot of different people who have, well, you talked about coming to a point of being comfortable within yourself with the understanding. So when I talk to a lot of people who have come to that point of being comfortable within themselves, I find a lot of things that seem to be the same, but I also come up with a minimal amount of differences among people where they don't teach exactly the same thing.
Exactly. I understand what you're saying, actually.
Yeah, okay. So there's a definite core of sameness and then a bit of difference. And so one thing that I always ask people to do is to listen within themselves for the inner confirmation. But a lot of people don't seem real comfortable with what that means. They're still very busy seeking outside, trying to find the answer, and they don't yet know how to listen within themselves. So I wondered if you could speak a little bit about what that was like for you, learning to listen within instead of outside for the answers.
Yeah, that's a very important question. And I think it is the main problem in the modern spiritual world, meaning the spiritual worlds in the more developed countries where tradition has been lost and people are, you know, seeking and very often get lost, as you say, in the outer and don't come back to this space within themselves to acknowledge what is really happening because there is no relationship to that space. You know, people don't feel comfortable going inside. At least I didn't at the age of 15. I didn't know what going inside actually meant because I was so used to thinking about everything, so used to looking at things from the perspective of mind, which is very useful, but very often the mind reacts to situations and so is actually adding a substance to the situation that is outside of itself. So we like people, sometimes we like people simply because we don't know really what the person is like. We just imagine them to be some sort of nice person because we're looking from a space of perception. So we're adding our social perspectives and our inner comfortable perspectives about people onto the outside picture that we're perceiving. And so because we're habituated to looking at the world from this sort of what I call the reactive space of the brain, which in neuropsychology is where the brain is basically processing information rather than being receptive to information, then really we don't have a possibility of acknowledging what receptivity or being open to the real picture means. And that was my first step in meditation, how to declutter the mind and how to let go of those habits that I was comfortable within or that I kept repeating so that what I was comfortable seeing or addressing or interacting with within myself was more than just a picture in my mind or a feeling that I have about someone or something or a situation or a social belief system or a cultural belief system or an idea because of my childhood and the constellation of family and dynamics. All those things that we're so used to utilizing as a reference to be comfortable in the interaction with the world or reality. So my first step was to unlearn all the learnings that created this sense of being comfortable with interacting just with one specific perspective that is out there in the dualistic world or out there in the world that we see or perceive, and to listen to my heart, not just the emotional part of myself, but more that depth of my being. And that took some time, that took many, many years. And I found it difficult to learn this by myself, simply because the people around me, beautiful and kind and loving as they were doing exactly the same and interacting in a very similar way with the world, and all their interactions were based on a reference on the outside. So I looked into the spiritual traditions of the world and was trying to find some sort of path that acknowledged that the inner world was important and had a system or a landscape or a way of reaching that inner world without dogma and without having to do certain things or believe in certain things or fulfill certain criteria to get to that point. And I looked into many, many spiritual and religious traditions and somehow just got in touch with Zen Buddhism, which at that time felt very easy and very familiar and very connected to just looking deeper into the perspective of reality. And at the age of 18, after 3 years of meditation, I decided, okay, I'll go for it. And went to a very well-known Zen master, a Japanese Zen master, to study in-depth meditation and to let go of that social, mental perspective of reality. And was in the monastery for a few years and feel that it created a very strong and clear basis as to how to develop this inner connection that you were highlighting as being important, and being comfortable with that inner connection so that I could trust my heart and not be so preoccupied or caught by the mental pictures that most of us seem to function from within.
Yeah, I love a lot of the things that you just now said. So I'm looking to see where my next question is going to be. Okay, I've got it. The next question then is, you talked about, you spent about 3 years, I think you said, first alone in meditation, looking and maybe discovering your own point of reference that you were using with the world, your own conditioning. And then you went to the Zen monastery where they assisted you. So I guess my question is, where do you feel that you were able to kind of see with yourself, and where do you feel that you needed help for additional seeing? Like, how does one know the amount of inner wisdom that's working fine on their own, and then when to ask for help from the outside, because maybe their ego is going to keep them stuck at a point and they won't continue?
Yeah. It's a difficult question to answer, because I think it depends very much on which culture you live in and how open-minded one is, the traumas that one has gone through, the family social conditioning that one is dependent on, which is, of course, what happens when you grow up. Your mind is referenced on that and develops according to that, and many other subtle factors. And for me, I was always a little bit of a rebel. You know, I didn't like listening to my parents. I didn't like listening to anyone. If someone said, do this, I would do the opposite. So perhaps this is why I spent 3 lonely years looking into meditation. I mean, I wasn't alone. I was working with a very famous psychology group that were researching consciousness. So, you know, I wasn't just sitting by myself in a room somewhere meditating. I worked very much in connection with people that understood the physiology of meditation, how to relax, how to work with body and emotions. But I felt that it needed to go deeper after 3 years, and that I wasn't able to do that in this group simply because it was a psychologically based meditation rather than a spiritual meditation. The spirituality was seen as interesting, but it wasn't really part of their reference of meditation. So then I was a little bit afraid, you know, to go into something that was too dogmatic. And so I looked at where is this help possible without someone saying that, you know, you have to do this or think like this or feel like this or dress up in this way or do this because this is how it is. And I don't know. For me, Zen Buddhism was interesting. And as soon as I realized that such a tradition existed, which I didn't know before because my family were not religious and I wasn't ever interested in religion and spirituality, then it just felt like right. And I think this is something that you can depend on inside of yourself when something just feels totally right and there is no doubt in your mind, this is what I need to do. It's like falling in love, you know. You're just in love, you know. You're not thinking, am I really in love? Or maybe some people do, but if it's right and, you know, it's truly deep love, then if you have that question, then you have to begin to ask yourself, am I really falling in love, or is it just my desires and needs being fulfilled on some level? And I just didn't have any doubt. And even though my family and people around me thought I was totally, what's the word, funny, and actually they use the word crazy, you know, how can you leave university? You are so, I was so good,
yes,
at studying anthropology and sociology, and my teacher said, you know, you have to go to university, it's so important for you, you're so clever, you know, it's a waste to go anywhere else. And I said, I'm not interested, you know, there is something else driving me. And my parents even worried, you know, I was in a cult or joining a cult. And, you know, even so, all these references that are important for me didn't stop me from going further. I knew that something was needed. Some external tradition was needed to help me through the dilemmas that I was facing within myself. And it wasn't enough to do it with psychology. It wasn't enough to do it with people who love me. I needed someone who had understood the practice from a lot of practice. And this Zen master, apparently, was, as was common in Japan during that time, was given to the monastery, as they used to do in Japan, the eldest son or the youngest son, given to the Zen Buddhist monastery to learn and grow up in a monastic environment, and never left. So had practiced, I don't know, by the time I met him, Zen Buddhism for 70 years. So I felt comfortable, even though the wisdom was slightly crazy for my understanding of how things really fit into the world of spirituality. I was challenged, and many things, many interesting things happened that I wouldn't have foreseen at the time when I made such a decision to go into the monastery. It was just right. And perhaps it's not right for everyone. Perhaps it's difficult to trust that inner feeling. But for me, it was so strong that I didn't even think about the doubt. I was just ready to go. And I think it's very important when you're at that point of transformation to work with someone who understands meditation very deeply. It's like music. You know, if you are learning an instrument, at some point, for most people, it is important to have a reference that can guide you to not go down those one-way roads or places that just end up being very frustrating and wasting very much of your precious time. And I felt this in the monastery for the few years I was there. But at every point, I was still a little bit of a rebel, and I didn't really like some of the more dogmatic aspects of Zen Buddhism. And of course, it is a cultural belief system. It's Japanese, and it's very beautiful, but still follows certain things that aren't very common for Western people, certain things that, you know, I would refuse to chant in Japanese. You know, well, I thought to myself, why should I learn Japanese? You know, it's not my language, so I would sit there and meditate rather than chant some of the sacred mantras in Japanese. Now I see it was just part of learning to let go of that stubborn aspect of myself and that rebel part of myself and to flow a little bit more with tradition. But at that time it was a great thing because I wasn't judged or I wasn't asked to leave because of being such a rebel. It was just seen as very cute. This young person, this young teenager in the monastery giving all and everything to go deeper.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny because what I hear is a wonderful inner balance that you were able to maintain. I'm sure you probably slip from side to side occasionally, or else you're not at all normal.
Yes, definitely. I did fall in love with some girl that came up part who actually I thought I fell in love, but I was infatuated by this person who was studying Zen Buddhism, who came up as part of a university course to study, you know, what the Zen Buddhist monks were doing and how they lived their life. And for a moment I was tempted to leave the monastery and follow that sort of more infatuated part of myself, but yeah, I realized that was not so important, and so continued meditating and falling for other things inside of myself rather than outside of myself.
Yeah, and
not that love is a bad thing, but you know.
Well, no, I understand.
It wasn't really important for me.
Yeah, I understand perfectly. I mean, I think that because I do a little bit of slipping here and there myself, and what the slipping does. Is it, at least for me, it gives me the opportunity to maybe taste something enough just to see that it's not that important to me.
Exactly. Exactly.
So it helps to keep you on balance.
Exactly.
I'm very interested in purification. So I'm very interested in how you experienced, you went a meditative path. I did not go a meditative path. In fact, I went the path of the contemplative. And in fact, I'm just beginning meditation, but I went through a lot of purification on my contemplative path. So I'm very interested in what it was like experiencing purification from a meditative path.
Yes, actually, this is very much part of the mystical path that in satsangs I share with people, how important it is to purify the physical body, and all the other bodies, but I usually start from the physical body. But actually, before meditation, I became vegetarian. So I changed my diet in a way that was very, very, at that time, it was seen as very strange to become a vegetarian, especially at such a young age. And part of why I continued then focusing on purifying the body, it's because I felt so much better. I couldn't believe how much better I felt physically and emotionally. So purification is very important in meditation for me. But I realized the more I meditated, the more it was important to have the space, the physical space and the emotional space and the energetic space where the body wasn't so dense or the emotions weren't so cluttered in confusion or the mind wasn't so agitated by the impurities that we as human beings just interact with in the world. And so I usually start with purification or highlight that purification is important on the very basic level, the physical level, meaning that you just look at what you're doing with your body and how your body, how aware you are of your body and how that awareness allows you to see what you're doing with your body. So, you know, if you are smoking, for example, which is, I'm not saying is good or bad, but if you're smoking, to bring awareness into the body to see, is this something you're doing because it is helping the body to feel alive and vibrant? Or is it because there is something that is not addressed and needs to be addressed through awareness, or perhaps through awareness and purification to transform, to give more space for meditation to go deeper? So purification is a very interesting topic, and I work with purification physically, but there is so much information about this now, so really I don't speak so much about this, but more to do with karma, what I call karma, which is just the subtle energies that are around the body that create frequencies, and those frequencies, if not aligned with the highest purpose of the body or emotional body or the energetic body or the mind, then don't have a coherence, so create conflict within, but we are not aware of this conflict. We're not aware of this conflict in our physical body because it's so subtle. It requires a tremendous amount of awareness to realize that we're not coherent in the way that we're interacting with our physical body. We need to be aware that the frequencies that we're dealing with are actually sabotaging or creating anxiety or stress, and so depleting our energy to a point where we just think that's normal. Because we're only used to interacting with the physical body on one level. And so purification then goes very deep into awareness. And I feel that it is important. Awareness is an important aspect of purification that is forgotten in today's world, where detoxification and vegetarianism or any dietism is put forth as gospel for, you know, purification, and I think there is much more to it.
Yeah, I do too. In fact, well, I did a lot of journaling is what I did, a lot of looking at every time that I was upset about anything. I did a lot of journaling to look and see what the real reason was that I was upset, and this is what I refer to as the purification and the contemplative path, even though I can't say it, I followed it. You know, just lots and lots and lots of looking.
Exactly.
So when someone...
That is awareness. That's awareness.
Yes.
That's the process of awareness.
Yeah, and so that's why I said I was curious how you did it in meditation, because for me it was a pen and paper thing.
Yes. Well, I mean, it can be done in many ways. It can be done through journaling, which is a beautiful way to bring awareness into the mind, but also into the reasons as to why one is doing certain things. Why do you keep repeating a certain behavior over and over again? Or why do you keep thinking the same thought, even though that thought is not in any way connected to the dream that you have deep, deep inside of yourself? Why? The question then is not replied to from your mind, but rather through the state of awareness that is facilitated by writing down in your journal, or painting, or music, or gardening, or in Zen Buddhism, for example, archery was part of that process of awareness where, you know, hitting the target was secondary, but usually when you were at one with the target, then you would hit the target anyway. So, you know, the awareness helped you to get there without the effort, without the struggle, without the fighting, without the negative mind creating all sorts of struggles within the experience of reality. So, yes, awareness, writing in one's journal, actually in the end, is the process of letting go.
Yes. So we're talking about cultivating awareness over being lost in mind.
Exactly.
Yes. So, tell you what, let's go back to your story for a moment. So I know that,
okay.
I know that Zen Buddhism wasn't your last stop on this journey.
No, I never considered myself a Zen Buddhist, really, but I respected Zen Buddhism because I felt that, unlike many other traditions that got lost in dogma, somehow they managed to keep the essence alive because it's such a mystical tradition. But actually, now that I look, there are many mystical traditions. Interestingly enough, I was not interested in Sufism, but I grew up in Egypt. My parents worked there. So, you know, I was influenced by the Sufi tradition simply because we had a cook who helped us when we lived in Egypt, and he was a Sufi. So I would just sit and listen to his stories, and they were mystical and they were beautiful, and they conveyed a truth that was beyond learning to think in a certain way. It was just a story that conveyed some sort of truth that was difficult to put into words. And so, you know, there is the Sufi tradition, there is the mystical Christian tradition, there is the Hindu traditions, the many Hindu traditions. And for me then, Zen Buddhism opened my love for all mystical traditions, and I got very interested in reading a little bit more about the various traditions, and also realizing that beyond those traditions, shamanism, which is sort of in anthropology the first spiritual experience human beings ever had, was also very similar to many of those mystical traditions in the sense that it was going back and connecting to more core aspects of oneself and connecting to that sense of oneness and awe and gratitude that one feels when letting go of all the problems that human beings have faced throughout history and throughout the evolution of humanity. And so I looked at all those things and decided that, okay, I'm not going to make a living out of spirituality because I felt this was wrong. You know, I have to work and earn money. And what am I going to do? And it was very complicated, really. And I thought, okay, I love nature. I love the ocean. I love swimming in the water. I love just nature. And so let me find a study that will be that will put me in touch with all those things that I love doing and at the same time give me a wage. And then studied marine biology, of course. And this is how I got into understanding that what we are learning today in biology has been practiced by native people for so very long. The respect of the earth and the interaction with the earth for native people, many native people, is totally different and has been the reason why they have managed to survive in the world for so very long without harming the world, usually without harming the world, and more connected and more happy from what I saw. And so studied marine biology, but then got invited to go to the Amazon forest and work with a group of people and native people and shamans, of course, which were preserving this area in the Amazon in a very beautiful way. And so got connected to shamanism and started to learn about what human beings practiced for thousands or hundreds of thousands of years that was mystical, and realized that people are the same. It's universal. Wherever you go, even though the cultural beliefs and the social beliefs and the language and the ideas are slightly different, in the end, I came to the conclusion that mysticism is universal. It's not this or that. And so felt very comfortable when leaving the Amazon forest and hiking up to the Andes with this more universal concept of mysticism that wasn't Zen, Buddhist, or Hindu, or Christian, or New Age, or whatever. And just felt comfortable speaking to people in the language that they spoke, rather than trying to speak from a religious perspective or even a New Age spiritual perspective. And this is how I've been sharing mysticism with everyone for a very long time. Actually, in the Andes or in the mountains of South America, this is where that experience, which I call coming back home to one's deepest state of consciousness, happened, and realized that I wasn't in a Buddhist monastery. I wasn't anywhere where people could say this was a mystical experience that you've had or an enlightening experience that you've had because you're practicing this tradition. Just happened. For no reason. I was just in total bliss. And then realized from that point that actually the work that I've been doing, the meditations and the curiosity and the questioning that I was asking as a child, what is the meaning of life? It wasn't the first time that I asked these questions. It seemed like an experience that went on forever and ever and ever. And so I connected, difficult to put into words, but I connected with this deep part of myself that was on the same journey and has been on the same journey for a very, very long time. And realized that that connection goes very deeply into a tradition that now I speak a lot about. And that is a tradition that I feel is beautiful because it is free of many, many concepts. And it's a tradition that I feel that is behind a lot of things. And this tradition is the mystical meditation that I teach now. I can speak more about it later.
Okay.
to give you a moment to speak.
Well, first of all, you know, again, I'm hearing a lot of perfection in your story. You know, when you zoom back from a story and look at it, you can see how there were no accidents ever. You know, like the Sufi cook in your non-religious life was not an accident.
But I forgot all about it, you know.
Of course.
When you're a child, that is what is around, and you don't think, oh, this is interesting or this is different. It's just, that's how it is.
But I'm assuming, and you can let me know whether my assumption is correct or wrong, I'm assuming that this tradition that you then found after your experience with shamanism and realizing the truth is beyond religion, is the way I'll word it, and the truth is for all beings, right?
Yes.
That the tradition that you found that really you felt most comfortable with, that would be Jainism, is that true?
Yes. Yes. The reason is because for me, what is really, really important, if I have to speak about one wisdom, that is the light that helps us to come back to this heartfelt space, that light would be, in English, the translation would be inner, deep, deep inner peace without conflict, without harming, without reactivity, without reacting to any externals, internals, just a deep connectedness. In Sanskrit, this is known as ahimsa, which means if you're free, then there is no need to think about tradition, there is no need to think about isms. You just follow the mystical path, which in the Jain tradition is called Dharma. You just follow your Dharma without question. You just do and practice what you know without labels. And I haven't really come across anything that simple. So because I wasn't brought up in the Jain tradition, when I remembered that this is what I was doing previously and I'd spent time meditating in this way. Again, it was like going to the Zen Buddhist monastery. It was like, oh, I'm back here. I know this place. There is no doubt or thinking or, you know, I am this or I am that. I just understood that in the end, whatever you say, whatever you do, whatever you think, whatever you feel, whatever your actions are, if they come from a space of deep, deep inner peace, then perfection shows itself in many languages and many ways. And there is no need to then hold on to a tradition. So I don't ever say that people have to follow this or understand this or that to come back to this realization, because actually everyone is unique. So every person, even every person following Jain Dharma, has to find it within themselves first. That is the practice. They can't find it outside in a spiritual tradition. It has to be from within. And that is a sign that you're following Jain Dharma. Actually, in the end, sometimes people who are Christians, Muslims, Hindus, follow the Jain Dharma better than people who call themselves Jain.
Yeah, I understand that.
So, you know, it's all words. So, but for me, the principle of ahimsa is very, very important. This is why I teach about not harming anything, not harming yourself, not harming others, not harming any aspect of the world through your thoughts or your feelings that have aggression within them.
Ahimsa. Okay, so I'm going to spell that for people who have not heard the word before. Correct me if I'm wrong in my spelling. I'm not looking at it. I'm just going by how it sounds. Ahimsa, A-H-I-M-S-A. Is that correct?
Exactly. Okay. Yeah, that's right. Actually, the terminology that would be most close to that concept would be what Jesus called love.
Love.
Yeah. But love is such a difficult word, because today some people have a connotation, you know, and as soon as you say love, people, oh, I had a painful experience, or, oh, you know, there are too many concepts hidden within that word. But the way Jesus spoke about love is ahimsa, because really he wasn't speaking about an external aspect of love. It's a connection.
Yeah.
So when you have that connection, then love is the natural consequence of that connection. And this is the same as ahimsa.
Yeah, non-judgmental allowance of everything as it is.
Exactly.
I remember once a boyfriend asked me how I wanted to be loved, and no one had ever asked me that question before. And so I contemplated that, and the answer that I came up with was, I wanted to be accepted. And that's when I realized that's what love is. Love allows.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, you can even go to the depth of how your physical body is structured. And when you understand that acceptance, or when you take that in as something that is so very profoundly part of your experience, and you accept everything within yourself, the way your cells function, the way that you breathe, the way that you see things, the way your perceptive senses experience the world, then there is so much freeing of energy. And this is why Jesus spoke about love as not a passive thing, but an active thing, because the energy then fills that space of love with so much energy, it becomes expansive to the point where it's unstoppable. And this is why it frees you from that which holds so many people back in suffering and in this conflict with themselves and the world.
Well, let's talk about ahimsa, or acceptance, or allowance, or love, whatever we want to call it. Let's talk about it for a moment, because, of course, I know, and I know that you realize as well, the mind argues with this, and it has very specific pet topics. For example, someone who has a disability, a disease that is really causing them a lot of trouble, or a loved one has a disease, you know, maybe it's cancer or something else. Some people get caught on the political way the world is, you know, like right now we have ISIS in the world and what's happening with ISIS. And, you know, people, they can understand acceptance of some things, but then there comes a line for a lot of people where this is not acceptable. And then they try to use spirituality somehow to correct the thing they find is unacceptable. Use spirituality to heal the disease. Use spirituality to fix the wars. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that's a very important topic, because a lot of people then conceptualize love, meaning that you have to be good and you have to think good, and then are confused when situations, like you say, you know, in the world, political or otherwise, are so incredibly the opposite. It doesn't fit into their world view or the perspective of love. And then there's all this doubt. How can you love someone who's creating so much suffering? Or how can you love a situation that is clearly terrible? But again, you know, if you listen to the mystics of the past, and also Jesus, what Jesus spoke about, you have to love your enemy. But for me, that doesn't mean you love from the perspective of just, okay, it's the way it is, so I just have to love it. That's like sitting on the fence and not actually actively participating in the experience of love. So you're just sitting and watching a movie. You know, it requires activity, meaning that you have to discern what is the situation. You know, even in spirituality, you know, if today I read a lot about the gurus and spiritual teachers and new ageisms, where teachers, spiritual teachers or so-called enlightened spiritual teachers, act in a way that is totally in contradiction to their teachings. And what, do you just sit on the fence and say, okay, it's how it is, I have to just accept the situation because that is what love means? That is not acceptance of the situation. That is just, what's the word? It is just a cop-out for a slang word. So discernment is different from judgment. Discernment is where you know the qualities of love, you understand the qualities of love, and you apply them in seeing if that situation that you're interacting with carries on and cultivates or nurtures those qualities further. So for example, I'm hopping from one thing to another because it's such a complicated topic, but for example, aggression, which goes against all Jain philosophy, meaning that, you know, you must not create suffering in another human being. For example, you must not kill another human being because that would create suffering, not only for yourself in the form of karma, but also for the other human being. And this goes against the principle of ahimsa. But what about if that human being is pointing a gun at you or your child, and what, you just sit there and you say, oh, love your neighbor no matter what they do? See, in Jain Dharma, people speak about, if that action is going to create a reaction that is more negative, then it is important to be discerning and see what the situation is all about. And then your actions need to be addressed from that discernment, not just from sitting back and not doing anything. So then, of course, what you will do if someone is pointing a gun at you is punch them. If you don't, you're silly.
Yeah.
But, you know, it still creates karma, you know, because it's not a good thing. And then you can begin to ask yourself, why were you in that situation in the first place? Why did you create the space where that is possible? But there is no time to philosophize when someone is about to shoot you or harm your daughter or, you know, harm your partner. You have to react. So this is discernment, because you are acting out of love. You're acting out of the principle where love, preserving the space that is allowing for love, that is what you are, that's where your actions are referenced. Even though if you look deeper, there is something else happening that you haven't addressed. And this is why it is important to continue honoring the principle of ahimsa, or the principle of love, so that you go deeper and for that situation never to arise in the first place. So your discernment is not just addressing the situation as is, but is also addressing the structure that allows for the situation to arise as is.
All right, so you... go ahead.
Now, this is what people forget. You have to look at the bigger picture. You can't just look at one specific situation. People in Africa starving. You can't just sit and do nothing about it. Of course you can't. But your activity can't be from a reaction to that situation. People treating animals in a terrible way, animal testing or, you know, the slaughter of animals in factory farming. You have people who then do things that come from a reactive space to address or to rectify that situation. And that is the beginning of many other problems. If you react to the negative rather than always reference yourself to the discernment, and the discernment always referenced within the space of love. So I believe that when Jesus said, love your neighbor, love your enemy, love everyone, it wasn't just a passive love. It was an active love that included a certain form of discernment and understanding that was applied within the spiritual practice.
All right, let me share back in my own words what I'm hearing, and then if you want to tweak it in any way, please feel free to. How's that sound?
Sounds good.
Okay, so what I'm hearing then is, you know, as long as we're living, there's a fine-tuning that can always be happening, and that the focus really needs to be inward, looking at our own reactive mind, looking at our own judgments, looking at our own inner violence, I'll call it, our thoughts, and purifying, letting go, seeing through, getting in touch with our inner self. But because of, I'll call it karma, like you do, there may be situations that are already somewhat destined to arise, and when they arise, we may temporarily move back to our reactive space, and if so, that just happened. It happened so quick. You know, when the guy jumped out from behind the bush, you did what you did, and it was over. But then an opportunity arises to go back and look again. Is this another opportunity for further refinement? And you do that afterwards.
Exactly. And if you have cultivated this perspective of love as part of what you do, what you think, what you feel, then that is a natural process that happens. This process of just coming back and looking at the situation that created a little bit of suffering and forgiving yourself and forgiving the situation that arose in that moment, so that there is a deeper sense of love that is created rather than just the reactivity. Because of course, if you punch someone, there is a form of anger, there is a form of tension, there is a form of primitive behavior that is aroused within the body. And if we don't address that, if we just leave it and forget it, it remains.
Yes.
Within the space of karma, within the space of the body, within the space of the mind, within the space of feelings, and it can come up again if you're not careful, because the brain and the mind is habituated to your actions. So if you do something a few times, then the brain thinks it's normal to punch someone, for example. And maybe it's better to ask, okay, why am I finding myself in this situation over and over again? And that requires the reference of love. That requires the discernment to see, okay, what am I doing here that could be changed? Or how can I transform the structure that is creating this situation that requires me to act in this way? And also another important thing is that really in the end, according to Jain Dharma and according to mystics and according to, I believe, also Christianity, pureness, or the most pure aspect of consciousness, supreme consciousness, can only be experienced after you leave this world. And this is in Jain Dharma known as Siddha consciousness. So this is a consciousness that is not dependent on your body. And if you're bound by the natural laws of your body, you still have this evolution within you, which is called fight or flight, and the primitive brain and certain chemicals in your body. And just by the fact that you sometimes breathe in microorganisms, you're causing suffering. You know, if you breathe in little tiny bug and you swallow it, it's causing pain. But that is what happens in the world. So in this world, we can't dream of heaven. We have to just practice love to its maximum and know that through those actions, we transform our body, we transform our mind, we transform our emotions so that we're ready to move to a state of consciousness that is free of all connections to negative circumstances where the need to punch someone or the need to cause pain or the need to shout at someone or the need to speak very strongly to someone who's doing something that is very dangerous or bad for your child ever arises. You're free of such limitations.
All right, so I have a question then, and the question is regarding going within. The question is regarding intention, I suppose. So what is the difference between living in the world with an intention of not harming from a place of love and living in the world with an intention of not harming from a place of guilt or fear?
Oh, there's a lot of difference. Do we have time?
Yeah, we still have some time.
Oh, you know, guilt and other negative attributes, such as guilt, cause harm in themselves and are harmful just in the fact that you are holding on to them inside of your body or inside of your thoughts or inside of your nervous system, inside of that, the experience of just being human. And every negative repeats itself and repatterns itself to a new negative without you even knowing, sometimes in the unconscious, sometimes in a realm that only becomes obvious given time when you look back. And so there is never love when you love someone out of guilt. It may look like love, or if you love someone out of fear, you know, for example, children, you know, who are treated badly by their parents because parents are stressed or anxious or because they don't have time to interact with their children in a different way, so just are aggressive and hit them or say, you know, negatives, you're stupid, what are you doing, you're silly, or whatever it is, or even worse, some worse things. And so that type of love will always recreate, or something like that type of dysfunctional love.
One moment, our connection is getting bad. I'm going to just pause for a second. Okay, again.
Yeah. I was just speaking about if a child was treated in a dysfunctional way and experienced that dysfunction as love. So, you know, the parent screaming at the child or hitting the child or doing worse things to the child, and then the child just seeing that as love and interacting with the parent and later on with a partner or with a friend, where the driving force that allows love to be experienced is coming from that negative. So it is repetitive. It is a structure that is repeated within oneself that is dysfunctional, but the outside picture looks loving. That cannot compare to love that is free of fear or free of guilt. And it is difficult if you don't know love in the true sense and you've only experienced, for example, love where there's always an element of fear. For example, I hear people say, oh, I love my partner so much, but I'm afraid one day they might leave me.
Yes.
And that is the sort of hidden energy behind a lot of the actions that are creating the constellation between the partner and the two people that are communicating this love. There is this element of fear and that tension. And it's difficult to say that it's not love, but it is dysfunctional. It is not love in the sense of being free enough to open yourself so totally that there is no fear of being hurt. There is no fear that it's like your parent who treated you in a dysfunctional way. There is no fear where perhaps your partner will leave or will say something that will hurt you or whatever it is. There's so many things people imagine in their subconscious mind as to the reason why they can't allow for that deep love, to be present in their experience of love, even to children. I see parents afraid. I remember working with someone and explaining, put your child down and relax. Let them run around. Oh, but they might hurt themselves. I'm afraid, because they were very young. I'm afraid that if I let them run around, that they'll fall and hurt themselves, or that they will do something, and I just need to hold them and control them. But that's not love. You know, if there is an element of negativity within the space of love, then something is not flowing, and it is totally different from ahimsa, because ahimsa's principle is that there is no conflict, there is no agitation, there is no harming, and fear, dysfunction, pain, suffering is harming you on some very deep level that you may not be aware of, and you may function in a way where you think, okay, I love my child and I love my partner, even though deep inside I know something is not totally right. That is not the same. And it's surprising for people when I say to them to let the child run for free and challenge that fear or that guilt or that whatever negative attribute that's inside of themselves, and to know that they'll be supported by their partner if their partner loves them, or by their child, simply because the child will no longer listen to that undercurrent and will listen much more to the real love that is being explored by the two people communicating a new paradigm towards one another. Okay, I let go of my fear, I let go of my guilt, because I love you so much, and I know that that love will heal. That's totally different.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, sometimes when people try to let go, of course, the fear or the guilt, I would call them, it's such a habit to be afraid, or such a habit to feel guilty for some people. They may try letting go for a little bit, and then they grasp back again because they're comfortable in that sense of the way they were trying to control, or in that way they were viewing things. What should someone do if they want to break out of this cycle of fear and guilt?
This is a very important point. And in neuropsychology and science today, actually, the neurons in the brain become habituated to react in a certain way. So it's out of most people's control, even. You know, it's not that you're doing something because you're thinking about it. Okay, this is how I'm going to do whatever I'm doing. You do it without thinking. So your actions lack awareness. So this is why neuroscientists today are looking at meditation as a very amazing way of reprogramming the brain. The neurons in your brain, when meditating, light up in different places that previously were not light, when you have all these different equipments which can investigate how the neurons are functioning in the brain. The brain lights up in different places, so it's not firing and wiring in one habitual way. But you're exploring new ways, and that is part of awareness, that you have an open mind. In Jain Dharma, this is called being open-minded, or seeing life from many perspectives, and being open to that and trusting that. And when you have the ability to do that, because you're bringing awareness into your activity and discerning that, okay, I don't need to always do this in this way. I don't need to recreate this action every time. Perhaps I can look at challenging myself and looking at things from a different perspective. And simply by thinking that thought, simply by creating that intention that you want to do things in a different way, and you're meditating and bringing awareness into that activity, then the neurons that are lighting up within your brain create new pathways and new structures, and you begin to explore things, and you begin to learn new ways. And that's the fantastic thing, is you begin to learn, you feel an excitement for life again, and you feel adventurous, and you feel that, oh, I can manage it, even though it seems impossible. I'm learning, I'm changing, I'm transforming. Things are beautiful because I don't have to keep repeating this old way of doing whatever it is that I've been doing for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. I can change. You begin to believe in yourself. You begin to, through awareness, see that there is a potential that you're closer aligned to when you are discerning the situation. Discernment is vital. When there is a negative, it is not just about acceptance. It is about discerning what that negative is, like you are doing through journaling, and through awareness, through meditation, through any activity that brings awareness and grounds you to the space of awareness. And then saying, okay, I see what it is. How can I move beyond this limited perspective?
All right, I have a question for you. I've never asked anyone before. Most of my questions are usually around the same, but this one is different because of the way you've taken me. So what is the difference between a reprogrammed brain, which is now kinder, more loving, more open, and truth realization or enlightenment? Is there a difference?
Well, a scientist would say no difference. But according to the way I see things, and mystics, many mystics, we are more than the physical brain. And we are even more than the energy, the electromagnetic energy that is emitted by the brain. Especially when the brain is reaching its highest potential, there is an enormous amount of energy that's released. We are more than that. We are what is known as essence or soul. In Jain Dharma, it's known as the soul, the light within that creates this understanding of potential. And this is more than your brain. It is very much part of how your brain functions when your brain is functioning in an optimum way, meaning that the neurons are not limited by the reactive primitive brain, our fight or flight mechanisms, or our fears or anxieties. And when not limited, then the brain is very close to the attributes of the soul, which are happiness, bliss, and joy. But you don't feel or experience happiness, joy, and bliss from the functionality of your brain. It is within the soul that is understood.
That's a beautiful answer. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we have approximately 15 minutes left. So what I'd like to do at this point in the interview is first ask the one that I'm interviewing, is there something that we haven't touched on that you really feel we should move to with this last 15 minutes?
Well, I am always interested in the way... Can you hear me?
Yes, I hear you perfectly.
Wonderful. I'm always interested in the way that new age or new spiritual traditions are forming in the world today. And I think it's a wonderful thing that is happening, that people are exploring new ways of seeing things and exploring new modalities of understanding the world that go beyond just the material one. But perhaps because we lack a tradition, and even though as a rebel, and that's my core, I always found it difficult to follow anything or to listen to a way of doing something that didn't somehow make sense to me. I feel that it is important to have a reference in tradition. And this doesn't mean historical tradition, but just understanding that spirituality is more than a supermarket. It's more than just shopping for the new technique or the new meditational paradigm or the new writer who's written something interesting and, you know, it's written in a way which addresses people in that setting. You know, every year things change, but people understand things a bit differently, and so people write up about it. I think it's important for people to go deeper within and to listen. Actually, this is what Jesus said also, you know, to just come back home to one's depth, or what I call one's soul. And the way to do this is to listen to your deepest aspect of heartfelt consciousness. and to be conscious of everything that you're doing. So I would say this would be something that's important to share with people, but especially with children, and to teach children the value of being aware, to teach children the value of just recognizing that space within themselves, simply by meditation, teaching meditation. The way I teach children meditation, for example, is very interesting, especially for young children. And I just ask them to play in their imagination. And for example, to imagine a situation, for example, if they're facing problems at school, if they're anxious or afraid of getting bad marks or afraid of being bullied or whatever the problem is, to sit down quietly for 2 minutes and imagine the solution, the perfect solution to that. And to sit there and just imagine whatever that may be, a little angel coming or someone helping you or a wise person explaining to you where to go and to find something beautiful, a treasure that guides you, or a treasure map that guides you to a beautiful space that helps you to find something. Whatever it is, just to play a little bit more with their potential and to connect to that potential. And I think this is important to do, not just for children, but for everyone. Beyond the dogmatism of what I call New Ageism, that is so very much part of the world today. And sometimes that New Ageism confuses people, because I remember speaking to someone and they say, "Oh no, crystals aren't for me." And meditation is much more than, you know, thinking or connecting to crystals, even though crystals are beautiful, you know. And people then have a reference that is very superficial about spirituality. And I think the practice is important, and teaching children that practice and teaching people at work the practice of just coming back to that heartfelt space of awareness is very, very useful. So this would be something important to communicate to people and your listeners perhaps, and other people who are lost in the world of spiritual New Age traditions that we are faced with today.
Yeah, it's a little sad how spirituality can be just another ego trap. I always tell people, do not become a spiritual person.
Yeah, and the problem is, it's also, a lot of it is made so superficial.
Yeah.
I was invited to go to a mind, body, spirit fair, and I never do these things anyway, but I just was helped to see what it was like. And you know, in the end, it's just like a supermarket. And
yes. Whoops, I lost you. Are you back? I'm going to disconnect. And I'm going to try calling him one more time. It is attempting to connect. Okay, it looks like we're not able to connect. So I'm going to end the interview here. And then maybe sometime I can get Tony back some more, because I think there were probably plenty of other things we could have talked about. So we'll see what happens. I really appreciated this interview, Tony. So thank you very much.